Today's show is a bit different. A couple of weeks ago, I heard this thing online that really struck a chord with me. It was this audio documentary about a lot of things, but it was about this small town in Texas. It was about a beat-up camper van and the kind of unusual lives of several Americans who, through some twist of fate, or maybe just sheer chance, they managed to wind up meeting each other at the exact right moments in their lives. It was both tear-jerking and hilarious, and I can't remember the last time that I've been affected that way by something I've heard on the radio. I wrote a message to the guy who made it, and I asked him if I could re-air the piece for an episode of Here Be Monsters, and much to my surprise, he said yes. And that's what this show is. It's an unedited re-airing of a piece made by a guy named Shopping Spree. I'm going to stick with the original title that he picked for the piece, which is The Friendliest Town in Texas. Just so you know, there's some pretty dark themes in here. There's suicide, there's prejudice, there's racism. There's a lot of swear words in here too, so none of those are bleeped out because, well, they're important to the story. But I understand if that bugs you, you might want to skip this episode. Enjoy the show. This episode of Here Be Monsters is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com, use the promo code MONSTERS9, and you'll get a full 20% off of your new website. Again, that's squarespace.com, promo code MONSTERS, and the number 9. Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
that meaty mayonnaised up white bread.
The podcast about
the unknown.
I'm Shopping Spree, and I would like to share something with you that happened to me in March of 2013. I have some apprehension of sharing this particular experience. Firstly, there is some temptation to keep it all for myself and tote it around like some magical personal secret, which I have obviously chosen not to do. And secondly, that it is simply too story-shaped to seem real. And when I tell it, part of me keeps toning down the most crazy parts for fear of sounding like a liar.
But what kind of real storyteller was ever afraid of that? And in ode to the people involved, it deserves to be told in its entirety, so take it or leave it as you choose. I'd been migrating from Washington to Louisiana with one of my best friends. We'd done a lot of the quintessential shit, hung out at the Mormon temple, saw UFOs in the desert that my dad said were actually B-2 bombers, good times. And we were staying in a place called Lubbock, Texas, with two folks that we met on couch surfing named Ben and Kathy. And Ben was this totally adorable, like big, loud, all West Texan type of guy, totally groovy though, traveled all over, spent 2 years chupacabra hunting in his camper van in Central America.
It's
totally awesome, dude.
This is the hustle. We have a Toyota camper that's in pretty rough shape. What it needs is love. And I do mean it needs love.
Well, it runs great.
The engine's perfect. It is the same camper we went down to Panama in.
Oh.
Is
that
yes.
His wife, Kathy, was absolutely wonderful. And this is her.
West Texas, chupacabra, camper drive, border collie loving, bed and breakfast, boy.
The next day, I bought that camper van from them they're just talking about.
I wrote that for our wedding. And surprised him and played it in my wedding dress. I was like, all right, bring my guitar. And he's like,
I didn't hear you say Benjamin Johnston.
Oh, I did leave that part out.
I spent the next day in Lubbock getting the camper van road ready with their friend Mark, who was a mechanic. I probably could have gotten the road a little earlier, but speed really isn't my style. And I also had to learn from Mark how the Tunguska event was actually an alien spaceship that entered the atmosphere at a weird angle and blew up. And that's what flattened all the trees. He will have his own segment on the show in the future. So now I'm driving to Austin in my new 1987 Toyota Dolphin camper van when I break down about a day outside of Lubbock, which wasn't entirely unexpected given the state of the camper.
Now, over the years, I've become a pretty good damsel in distress, so the first thing I do is go to a nearby farmhouse, where I have a pretty cute but confusing interaction. My poor little cell phone's out of batteries, as usual. Later, when it was about to get dark, a couple pulled over and got out of their car to help me. Their faces were very tan, very wrinkly, and when they smiled, their wrinkles and creases sort of conspired to draw all your attention to just how intense their smile was. But they looked directly at me when they spoke to me. The man was shaggy and plaid, and after looking under the hood, he asked if we could join hands and pray, and I agreed, because it probably couldn't break the car anymore, or so it seemed at the time. The man prayed that his deity would send me safely on my way and get me where I was going. And afterwards, he turned to me with a wild new shock in his blue eyes, which was stark across his otherwise generally pretty tawny, worn sort of shade. And he said, "Now you go and try and start her up again." By his god, like most gods, doesn't holla back at atheists. He left me there on the side of the road, but not before imploring to me that his lord worked in mysterious ways, son, and you'll be in my prayers. Well, I'll mostly just be here on the side of the road, I thought. But I smiled and thanked him genuinely, and the warm, strange way they left me feeling was good at the time. Don't judge me, I like when people are nice to me. I sat on the roof of the camper and looked at the moon. It was totally full, and fuck full moons. It's 2013 and werewolves saw everywhere. I had my humerus broken by a full moon over the holidays. I was on a sled with my vodka, just sliding down the icy road, minding my own fucking business when the moon saunters out from behind a cloud. And that's, I guess, just when shit gets real. This should have crossed my mind as the thick glass half dome shielding the toilet vent shattered beneath my weight, leaving a whole big bloody moonlit mess everywhere I went for the next hour, but still, it's hard to say I wasn't enjoying myself as usual. The next morning, I set out to hitchhike into town, not totally aware of the large swaths of now dried blood running down the back of the camper van. That's the type of look that keeps people from messing with you, and in most small towns, would keep people from stopping, but in the friendliest town in Texas, I was noticing them for the first time in the rearview mirror of the back seat of the first car that went by on the road that morning. In the front seat is a professional-looking father-son duo, round, clean, and polite, generally just a smooth, shiny duo. I imagine that their body odor probably smelled like an especially stringent form of new car smell. They tell me that I am lucky to be stranded in Coleman, Texas, because among other things, it is the friendliest town in Texas. Believe it or not, I think I'm pretty good at humming and hawing with these types of folks that work at Texas garages. Ignore the divine feminine spirit and pretend to be my dad or one of my uncles, as long as I'm depending on the expertise of these mechanics. The secretary is the only one who I failed at making friends with, which is often the case with myself and secretaries. The afternoon while the camper van was at the garage, I had the privilege of being in the magazine section of the local library as school got out, which is like the counterculture center of Coleman, Texas. I was there, pretending to read a magazine and drink a cup of coffee and actually spying on people, but I guess I actually wasn't pretending to drink a cup of coffee. The coffee was real. There was a boy of about 12 or 13, short and plump and Latino, sitting at a computer watching a YouTube tutorials, folding the most absurdly complicated origami for about 3 hours until the library closed. The librarian had heard about my situation from somebody and offered me hospitality, but I told her that I could sleep in the RV and that the people of Coleman were truly friendly. She looked back at me beaming and said, "It used to be up on a billboard on Highway 2, friendliest town in Texas." And you cannot not smile at these people. There were two skinny white kids looking like small feral Mexican dogs waiting outside for the boy who had been inside folding origami, with all the quintessential little comments, "Nice bike basket," and "You like fat girls?" And although visibly uncomfortable, the younger boy said nothing. "Nah, he don't even like girls," one of them sneered. Now, most queer people know this situation intimately, but it never not catches you off guard for some reason. I walked over to the chubby little kid as his dainty little hands, suddenly lacking their dexterity they had had in the library moments before, were desperately trying to undo his bike lock. "You don't have to listen to those goons," I said. He looked back at me like a frog I had just shined a bright light upon, sort of stunned. The tremors in his hands had stopped. You know what? Fuck those guys. You don't have to like girls if you don't want to, and you don't have to live in this town forever either. His face now is a cheeky shade of shocked, probably just because he got to hear an adult cuss, which was always a treasure. He kinda smiled at me nervously, very squeakily and very slowly. He went where he was going. I don't really know if I said this for his or my benefit. It kinda seemed like half the houses and businesses in this town were completely empty. Many of the homes would appear totally vacant until a mongrel on a chain would burst through a dark doorway from some hidden corner of the yard to announce your passing, or you might see a strangely valuable car in the driveway, or a curious yet suspicious of you prepubescent human on a bicycle. Quiet neighborhoods. Not empty, but still kind of abandoned. The dogs in that town made you feel like you were trespassing just by strolling by them on the sidewalk, which is really the opposite of the people. I talked to so many people in that town, just kind of floating around. I got fed twice, offered a place to sleep, which I amicably declined, looking forward to spending another night in my new home. In the dusty guts of the camper van, I found an old Mexican bottle of wine, which I drank while I sat in the dark and played guitar. I wrote a song about being fried alive at the age of 25, which you can hear now. You'll see why this is kind of funny in a minute.
This one's deep serious, folks. All you fooling human beings, you blokey dopes. I'd hope to be fried and alive by 25 queer years here. I'll take 24 more singing into the corner.
I got on the road the following morning after a Texas-sized amount of schmoozing with the guys at the garage. On my way out, the secretary looks at me and says, in a melange tone of contempt and sour southern hospitality, says, "You probably won't get very far."
Whatever, bitch.
My ultimate mood was only slightly denatured by the price of filling a camper van with premium gasoline, which felt like a weird rite of passage, never having bought premium gasoline before, but whatever, I was happy to be on my merry gay way. So there I was, driving my 1987 Toyota Dolphin, full of premium gasoline, blasting Cyndi Lauper, leaving the most friendly town in Texas. When I hear a popping sound, which I don't really think much about, because that concern is truncated by the unsettling realization that I have no brakes, which becomes an imminent concern, but I don't really think too much about it, because the smoke rapidly slinking through the dashboard and filling the cab gets my immediate attention, as does the new heat source from somewhere near my sandal feet. I am suddenly only thinking about that giant tank of premium gasoline I just bought that I'm currently sitting directly over. The camper's front seat and the center console are covered by this puzzling fuzzy synthetic hair, which I suppose was the first thing to really catch just before the drapes on the passenger side. In my memory, it seems like really instant, but I really couldn't tell you how long it took. I snatched up my sketchbook, which was sitting in the passenger seat, just in time to jump ship to the side of the highway to watch the RV go up like a cigarette. A woman got out of the car that had been right behind me on the highway and runs up to me, panting and limping. She puts her hands on my arm. "Oh, baby, was anybody else in there?" I tell her no. "Oh, honey, you have an angel watching over you today." That's not particularly how I felt in this moment. She continues as we watch the RV burn together. "Now my heart is breaking for you. It is actually really breaking." I felt a little bad because my heart wasn't really breaking at all at this point. Not until her expression strengthened and she turned to me and spoke again. "Now 3 years ago, I watched my husband take his own life, and last night I made the decision to end my own life, and I tried to, but I couldn't do it, and I prayed and prayed, and this morning I decided that if I could help one more person, it is worth my time staying alive one more day." And that's how I met Jennifer White. I wish I could have a photograph here of the face I was making. I really wonder what it would have looked like. I imagine it as equal parts shocked and smug, though I really have no idea. In the past, I have delighted in disaster more readily than some. It was really nice standing there on the side of the highway, listening to her talk about her dead husband, watching the black smoke shadows across the road. Coleman, Texas had been in a 4-year drought, and at some point I was starting to get nervous about the amount of surrounding prairie that was going up in fire, but this moment was probably the only one of its kind, waiting there with this woman. After some imperceivable amount of time, the fire trucks arrived, and the news crews, and the police. I granted an incredible interview to a local news station featuring the only other survivor of the fire, which was a WWF action figure who sat pinned between the cab and the antenna. You know, we kept him there just in case shit went down. He had my back. And he did. He made it out of that incident with a pretty bad sunburn, but we were both more than happy to talk to the news crew, and he was especially excited. Honestly, at this point in my life, I don't really own a whole lot that means a lot to me, but inside the camper van had been my travel guitar. And it had been with me for the last 3 years. It was a total piece of shit, but it had been my companion through about 10 different countries. We had been through quite a lot together. I was casually kicking through the wreckage to see if I couldn't find a little piece of hardware or a keepsake or something. And the tow truck drivers, a sympathetic duo, helped me look. "You know, I tried to play guitar a little while back," says one of them vapidly. I helped them load up the melted pieces of my little snail shell, as my mother had referred to it on the phone the night before, into the back of their tow truck. Because I hadn't changed over the deed to my name, and the deed itself was in the melted glove box, I was personally responsible for the singed corpse of my Toyota Dolphin, and we cannot scrap it by law. After some hanging out and a little more humming and hawing, the older of the duo agrees to remove the plates off the wreck until it falls through a loophole in the law that he can scrap it as his own garbage. For some reason, basically, he does me a huge favor. Homeboy for sure. He then sends me to lunch with the younger of the duo, who drives me around in a giant, shiny yellow Hummer, and we go buy fried chicken from his girlfriend who works up in the drive-up window. She giggles when she meets me. "We've been hearing about you all morning." Back at the tow truck driver's house, which is about only 30% bigger than his car, we are sitting eating fried chicken and looking at his sweet reptile collection when he asks me, "So you play that guitar you lost often?" I tell him, "Yes." "And it meant something to you, huh?" "A little," I say. "A lot. Some unquantifiable, undefinable amount." "Well, you know, I got this guitar. It's an electric one. I had it been sitting in the closet for years. You know, you could just go ahead and have that one. I'm tired of looking at it." He goes and gets a hard shell case out of the closet and puts it on the floor. I try to tell him that he should keep it, that I could get another guitar easily, and that it's less likely that he'll ever learn to play guitar if he gives away his only guitar. He tells me that he mostly listens to that nigger music anyway. Exactly. Texans leave little wiggle room in which to refuse their hospitality, so I agree to take the guitar, and I tell him that I also listen to a lot of rap.
"We can do it how you wanna do it, nigga. The killer on the Reese's well earned, go figure."
I begin to ask him what sort of guitar it is, and then he tells me he doesn't really know nothing about it, and that he's had it forever, and I assume it's probably some shitty off-brand, an old Squire or something like that. But whatever, I'm grateful to have another guitar. Before that conversation can coalesce any further, we get really stoned and he tries to convert me into a Jehovah's Witness, which is interesting. I mean, actually interesting. That religion is fantastical. He drops me off at the garage where I see the shiny father-son new car smell duo waiting for me. "We heard all about what happened to you, and the good Lord is watching out for you today, son," the younger of the two says, although I have a suspicion that I'm a little bit older than he is. Not in Coleman, Texas. Everybody wants to be your daddy in Texas. I'm nonetheless glad to see friendly faces, although it is dawning on me that another day in this town will oblige me to have this conversation infinity times with all my new friends. We talk about how it happened, and they tell me the theory about the fuel line or a cylinder or whatever. I would have been trying to learn about these new things a few hours ago. It's all nachos to me now. They ask me where I plan to spend the night, and I tell them about the woman that I've met on the side of the road. They respond with matching sideways looks, and the father of the duo asks for her name. "Jennifer White," I tell him. He says that we better call the sheriff and see what he has to say about her, because you just never know in this town. And I am wondering what you just never know about the friendliest town in Texas, when the younger one begins to tell me a story about how one time me and my friends were all in a nearby town at another friend's birthday, and we were staying with my sister's friend, and they said y'all could just sleep in our living room, and we got a few guests in there already, and they were like a bunch of gay guys. I mean, seriously, just a bunch of gay guys. So you know we said no thank you and got a motel. I mean, so you never know these days. He trails off chuckling. I wish I had a photo of my face here also. It probably was a weird shape as we laughed together at separate things. Me at him, and him at something that I never thought was particularly funny, but I keep pretending to laugh until the father of the duo gets off the phone saying, Sheriff says he knows that woman you're fixing to stay with, and she ain't got an ounce of harm in her body, but she's an absolute Looney Tune. Freaks of a feather. Flock together. They then proceed to tell me about the assortment of village Looney Tunes, amongst the most renowned being a man and his wife, who live out in the sticks but come into town to set up their lawn chairs and wave their saccharine signs, slightly Jesus-flavored, at the passing traffic, just telling people to smile. To distract myself from the overwhelming new car smell, I decided to open the hardshell case and meet my new musical friend. The last time I fawned over this guitar, I was about 13 or 14 years old. Cutting it out of a geeky guitar magazine and scotch taping it onto my wall as if somehow that made it slightly more likely that someone like me would be in the position someday to own a guitar worth that much somehow over the course of my life. And it totally worked, because here I was in the back seat with a vintage Gibson SG that had finally found its way into my lap, its proper place in the universe. Later, upon examination of the underside of a pickguard, I would find where all the previous owners had etched their names and dates into the plastic. RWN 72, David W. Courtney 76, Crunch 1089. Which is noteworthy only because my musical moniker, to which this guitar is indefinitely indentured into, has been previously knighted as Crunchy Person. Don't forget it. The guitar had cast upon me a bewildering spell of which I was utterly under when the son of the duo yells back at me, "There he is! There's the fella I was telling you about! He's holding that goofy sign that says smile." I raised my eyes to meet the face of the tawny-worn man who prayed over my engine 2 days ago on the side of the road. He is looking directly at me, smiling a smile that says he remembers the last thing he said to me out there on the side of the highway about his deity in mysterious ways. I wish I had a photo of my face here also. As the two men in the car wave and smile conservatively behind their shiny sunglasses atop their shiny faces, the tawny, scruffy man looks directly at me and smiles a smile that is all smile and no shine. He mouths, "God bless you," as we drive away, and my mouth is drying out from hanging open for so long, but I wish I could have just hung there staring at him forever, exchanging looks like, well, how about that? Jennifer White takes me to her mother's home. A vortex of framed Jesus/Mary/family ephemera, over-decorated to the point of psychedelic, which is my personal preference for decor. Jennifer gave me a lunch that she had been intending to take to somebody else, but insisted that I have it. I ate that meaty, mayonnaised-up white bread and listened to her mother talk about how she could see angels around me, and I told her that her daughter was the only one that had got out of her car to see how I was during the entire ordeal. And her mother paused, lost somewhere in the enormous TV. Oh, she knows what it's like to have bad things happen. Jennifer White loves Journey. I used to hear him sing and say, "Yeah, that's the man I need to marry. Now I'll marry any man who wants to marry me." Journey fucking rocks. Ethan is her 10-year-old son. He likes video games and pop music and dinosaurs. 3 years ago, her husband Seth left the two of them by taking his own life, which he did in front of Jennifer, but not before she could walk into the other room and turn up Ethan's Nintendo so he wouldn't be able to hear what the adults were doing. She takes me to 2 grocery stores, a Hastings, a laundromat, and a pizza buffet where you can smoke inside, and feeds me throughout all these errands. Her and both her parents are diabetic. She encourages me to go back for seconds and thirds, and I do. "Just life is so real," she says. "Just so real, you know what I mean?" "Yeah, it's always fragile," I reply. She stops eating and looks taken aback. "You know, I never would have thought to have said it like that. That is exactly what I wanted to say." And before I can say that I'm not the first person to say life is fragile, that's just something that people kind of say a lot, she turns to Ethan, who is still eating his pizza. It has macaroni and cheese as a topping. She says, "You know, Mama had an angel enter into her life today, baby." Now, when someone accuses you of being an angel, it's really awkward to correct them. It's kind of like turning down food from a Texan. After we get back to her home, we sit on her porch and smoke cigarettes. Ethan protests, "If you knew the kind of day this man has had, Ethan, you would let him have a cigarette." I agree with Ethan that neither of us should smoke, but that doesn't stop me this evening. She tells me how Seth's ghost still visits her from time to time, protecting her and haunting her in equal parts, from what I can deduce. I played her some songs I had written, and I taught Ethan how to play his favorite pop song on guitar. Ethan tried to teach me how to play a game on Nintendo, and I kept thinking about what Jennifer White would look like coming into the room and just turning up the volume on the TV and going back and closing the door. I stayed up really late with Jennifer. Our conversations were boundless and easy. She told me about her relationships, including her current romance over the internet with a man she had never met in person, known as Fiancé, who was pressuring her into marrying before she really wanted to, and how I must come and be in the wedding. She told me how she had convinced herself last night that Ethan would have been alright without her and with his grandparents. She told me about high school, and she told me about her health problems. She told me about every time she ever seen a ghost. I told her that there weren't enough people like her in the world. It becomes obvious by the way she reacts to what I say that she's not used to being treated well by male-bodied folks. That night we watch ourselves on the evening news where they completely cut out all of my interview and all of Mr. Melted Action Figure's interview, but show a brief image of Jennifer, as the newscaster said, and a mysterious woman appeared on the side of the road offering help. Total high five. I thank the good Lord so much for bringing you here, she says. Perfect timing. God has perfect timing. And in this moment, there's nothing I can really say to disagree. The next day, Jennifer takes Ethan out of school so we can hang out. We mess around for a few hours in the morning, and I try to explain plate tectonics to Ethan. He keeps making future plans for the two of us, not really processing my imminent departure, but hey, I've been trying to leave Coleman, Texas since before I got here, so who am I to say I'm going anywhere at this point? Jennifer calls me into her room, and she stands there in her big bathrobe with her night blindfold, desperately trying to hold on over her large force of frizzy brown hair, and she thrusts a thick, heavy cross necklace on a gold chain into my hands and holds it there. She says that I've given her a second chance, and that she will think of me every time she feels like doing something stupid, and that my safety means a lot to her, and so may this cross grant me safe passage. She takes me out to breakfast at Whataburger. I meet more of her friends. While passing her son a third packet of syrup for his pancake breakfast combo, which comes with a large soda pop, and in Texas it's fucking huge, she gets a call saying that her uncle is on his deathbed in the next town over from diabetes. That afternoon, after a lengthy and prolonged goodbye in which I have to convince her that she doesn't have to drive me all the way to Austin, and I promise to return for the impending wedding in December, she drops me off at the side of the road at a hitchhiking spot of my choosing. She is teary as she leans out the open window. "You know, you saved my life," she says. I mouth, "God bless you," as she drives away, watching Ethan play Nintendo DS in the back seat. The irony that that lip-syncing might have been one of the most sincere things I've ever said isn't lost on me for long, because irony has always found me easily. I see my face reflected briefly in the windows of the passing cars, and my expression is probably one of the weirdest I've ever seen on my own face. It looks like I'm trying to be sentimental while pooping out a watermelon. No wonder it took me 4 hours to get picked up. I've met and stayed with plenty of folks on the road who could have easily had incredible secrets that I won't remember, but I'm really looking for those people who splatter their ingredients across me like a burrito hitting a windshield. I always like getting sucked into other people's stories. And in this case, it wasn't really for me to tell Jennifer that I wasn't an angel, but I'm an atheist, and I think her fiancé is a con artist. I had a heartwarming and timely cameo in the Jennifer White story, but I was kind of written into it, for lack of my own words. I didn't really deserve to be the one who saved her life, but right place in the right time, and we both had something to gain. I was never one who could honestly be of faith, but the gratuitous warm fuzzies I got from pretending to be in a setting where everybody else already was helped me to understand what holds those value systems in place. And I totally wear that blingin' gold cross necklace every day, and I'm still an atheist. But most people probably think I wear it satirically, which would certainly be in line with my character, but there's nothing sarcastic about how I wear this cross. It's funny how many things this cross represents to me that most Christians would agree with: the boundless generosity, an untethered heart, grace beyond my pace enough to melt my face. While most folks use Jesus, I have Jennifer White. I'm gonna leave you now with one last little piece of shit. This is a demo of a song that I wrote about this woman. It's not as much of a song as it is just me rambling my feelings about her over this loop that I'd made, but I play it now on the street of New Orleans where I live. with the guitar that I got from this experience, so it kind of ties it all together.
You've been a punching bag once or twice in your life, Jenny White.
A couple times I thought you might.
There's atheists that stare behind the lights of your eyes, Jennifer White. It's out of sight that you didn't take your own life last night.
How'd you decide?
Not anything at all. Oh, not many 10-year-olds I know would like to live through a suicide twice. To like being alive all the time, that's alright.
That's good, man. You have the news. Your ex-baby daddy Boo said suicided himself in front of you.
But first you walk into the other room and you turn up the TV.
So your son didn't have to hear what the adults were up to.
What's such grace beyond my pace? That's just grace to melt my face.
Use your grace to melt my face.
Bees, grease, and love bombs, even a TV threat.
Actually content,
being secretly pregnant.
It's mean I mean no disrespect.
And for sure you got your reasons.
So I don't care much for Jesus, but I sure believe in Jennifer White.
You don't have to like me alive all the time, Jennifer White.
Die. That's quite alright.
That track and most of the rest of the music you heard on today's show was written and performed by Shopping Spree himself. If you'd like to hear more of his music, he performs under the name Crunchy Person, and you can find it all on Bandcamp. That's crunchyperson.bandcamp.com. Some of the other tracks you heard on the show today were from Javelin and Seagull Invasion. Herbie Monsters is an indie podcast, and it survives through the support of fans like you who are downloading and sharing and tweeting and Facebooking and iTunesing and SoundClouding and telling your friends about the show. And if you're doing that already, then thank you. We appreciate it. But if you aren't, then you should think about sharing the show if you enjoy it. Also, head over to the website, which is hbmpodcast.com, hbmpodcast.com, where you can find links to the show's contact info. You can also read producer bios, and you can find out if you have something to sell, how you can sell it on the show by becoming a sponsor. Hit us up on the email. You can find that address at hbmpodcast.com. And in case you didn't know, Here Be Monsters is a part of the Mule Radio Syndicate, which distributes a whole slew of great podcasts, including podcasts like Everything Sounds and Audio Smut. So if you haven't checked those shows out already, head over to muleradio.net, where you can find them and a lot of other good stuff. Hope you enjoyed the show, and thanks for listening.